With that, I am going to turn it over to our prayer chair, who is going to do our step three prayer. Cynthia.
Thanks, Mark. Cynthia Alcoholic.
Hi, Cynthia.
We will take a moment of silence for the still suffering alcoholic, both in and outside of these rooms, and then the third step prayer. We can have that moment now. God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. And I'm going to pass it along to Stacy to do the reading.
Thanks so much, Cynthia. I'm Stacy, I'm an alcoholic. Grateful for another day. I'm not trying to get sober again. It's my pleasure to introduce Miss Holly. I met her on a Zoom and now we're new best friends. So and it's fabulous. So she's going to get to talk about step three today. So I'm going to read. I'm on page 61. Okay. What is his basic trouble? Is he not really a self-seeker even when trying to be kind? Is he not the victim of the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if he only manages well? Is it not evident to all the rest of the players that these are the things he wants? And do not his actions make each of them wish to retaliate, screeching all they can out of the show? Is he not, even in his best moments, a producer of confusion rather than harmony? Was that the right read? Okay, all right, good. Go. I want to know why that was the right reading. Hey, Holly.
Hi, Betty. Oh my God. I'm Holly. I'm an alcoholic. Get that out of the way. Sobriety date, September 28, 1996. I have a sponsor. My sponsor is the amazing Miss Polly P. She has a sponsor, and she has a sponsor. I love the lineage that I come from, and then I sponsor women. So I am resting comfortably, or sometimes not so comfortably, in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Stacy, Mike, oh my God, the really cute guy sitting in his car emceeing. Mark. Thank you. And Ashley, thank you so much for your service. This is amazing. And Stacy, thank you for asking me to be here today. I'm super, super excited. Anytime I can be included in something that has young as the first word, it just like totally makes my day. So thank you. I'm young today. So yes, that's the right reading, because that is the story of my life, all summed up in just three maybe little sentences. And I want to tell you a little bit about this morning, because there are no coincidences that I have to talk about step three today. And I'm telling you, anytime I ever have to talk about a step, something relevant to the step occurs in my life. I mean, step three is sort of an everyday thing, but I mean like something, you know, a little more relevant occurs about the step whenever I have to talk about it. And I found myself on my knees this morning. As well, I'm on my knees all the time, but a little longer down there this morning. And when I was talking to God about a little situation that I'm new in, I'm uncomfortable in, I don't really know what's happening, and I don't know how to do it. And, you know, so I'm basically, I have no idea what I'm doing, which means I have no good, knowledgeable control of the situation, which means I don't have a plan A or a plan B or a plan C or, you know, any of the multitasking, you know, kind of leadership quality kind of girl that I am outlined for this particular area of my life, which basically means that, you know, I met a guy. So that is a very, very confusing thing for me, because I don't even know if I met a guy. I mean, like, I haven't even met the guy. Like, I can't even tell you, like, what goes on in my mind. I don't know. You guys, on my knees this morning, and I'm talking to God, and these are the words that come out of my mouth, right? These are the words that come out of my mouth. Help me, God, help me figure this out. I swear to God, that's what I said. Help me, God, figure this out. Have you ever started a sentence to God with help me blank? And it hit me. I mean, it was like, bam, right between the eyes. Because what I was really saying to God this morning was, please, God, line up as much mojo as you possibly can for me to get my way. That's exactly what I was saying to God, and it really hit me how relevant step three is. And is she not a victim of the delusion that she can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this life if she only manages well? Oh my God, I have that sentence circled, highlighted. My book is right in front of me. Little asterisks all around it. It is my favorite sentence in the big book, not because of how it affected me when I was drinking, but because how it affects me right now, today, with 23 years sobriety. I think it is, to me, the most important sentence in that book. You know, and it's interesting because in the 12 and 12, there's a line that says, and I'm going to paraphrase because I'm horrible about quoting unless the book is right in front of me. Well, it is, but I've got the big book open. There's a line in there that says, I got to read it. I'm sorry. I'm going to just completely mess it up. It says, in fact, the effectiveness of the whole AA program will rest upon how well and earnestly we have tried to come to a decision to turn our will and our lives over the care of God as we understood him. What? Like, no kidding. The effectiveness of the whole AA program rests on how well I do that, how well I make that decision every day. That's scary. You know, I thought the only thing I had to do 100% was step one. You know, like I have to get the whole concede to my innermost self I'm an alcoholic thing, right? Otherwise, nothing else works. But that's not the case for me today. The case for me today is, and it's not even about trusting God. I am here to tell you that I trust God. I have enough footprints in the sand that I can look back and I can see over and over and over how God has taken such amazingly good care of me in every situation in my life. I have enough experience to know that. I have enough experience to know that no matter what, I'm going to be okay. I know that. I know that to the core of the fiber of my being. It's not a trust God problem. It's the fact that sometimes I want to co-pilot. Sometimes I think I know. I think I know. You know, we write and we identify and we do inventories and we get a clear-cut picture of who we are. And I still struggle with step three. I still struggle with letting go of the helm because somehow I think that it's kind of like, do you ever ignore your GPS? Or maybe I'm the only one that ever does that. But, you know, my GPS will be giving me directions somewhere. And she'll be talking to me and she'll say, take a right. A quarter of a mile. You'll be taking a right on whatever street, right? And this is me. Well, you know, that's a good idea. But I think that this other way might be better. I'll probably get there faster. It just makes a little more sense. You know, there might be traffic. I don't think maybe Google Maps knows the traffic today. And I go my way. Invariably, it was the wrong move. It's always the wrong move. We must listen to Google Maps. We must listen to Siri. It is always better when I do that. But I always think that maybe my route, the destination is the same, right? Whether we go the way I want to go or the way that Google Maps wants to go, destination is the same. It's the journey there. Therein lies my problem, the journey there. How I get from point A to point B, very often I think I have a less painful plan than God's plan. Because see, I'm not afraid of the destination, I'm just afraid of the journey. Isn't that the deal, right? I think that if I can manage the journey, I'll get where God wants me to be and it won't hurt as much. And it was interesting because I had a little cry this morning when I realized that, oh my God, I'm asking God to help me. And I realized that I don't need God's help and he actually doesn't need mine. And I had a little laugh after a couple of tears and I got up and I called somebody because this is what I do immediately. And interestingly, a sponsee texted me and said, hey, got time for a call? And I told her I was having a third step weak moment and she walked me through it because that's the way sponsorship works in my life. You know, it's shoulder to shoulder and sometimes I'm listening to them and giving them advice and sometimes they're listening to me. And pointing me back in the right direction. And then she said, what are you doing today? And I said, well, I have to talk on step three. And we both began laughing hysterically because it was like, yeah, we teach best that which we want to learn, right? Yeah. I want to share my experience, my strength with step three, just the way it works in my life right now, right now. It is so important to me to have joy in my life and to not give that away. To not give it away. And I am the one that gives it away. You know, there's a line in the book that it says, our troubles we think are of our own making. And the first time that I read that, I thought, well, that's not good. You know, I don't want to be the troubles are my own making. No, they're not. You didn't know my daddy and my stepdad number one, stepdad number two, stepdad number three. You know, you didn't know all those guys and you didn't know husband number one and husband number two. And you don't know about all the things that I've gone through. Certainly the troubles, some of the troubles were not of my own making. And I resisted that idea. And I am here to tell you that that line will set you free. It has set me free, just like this morning. Because see, if I think that my happiness and my life and my joy and my sobriety are contingent on outside things, I'm doomed. I'm absolutely doomed. But if I know that all of my troubles are of my own making, then the only thing I have to do is take me to God and I have to try the best I can to keep me out of the way. And then maybe I won't have so many troubles. Wow, what a freedom, right? What an incredible freedom. And it is absolutely not where I came from. And I want to tell you a little bit about my first experience with step three and not just all about my problems today. So that you have an idea of this kind of this journey. How did I get here? And when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a God. I did. I was raised with a God. My first God was my daddy. Absolutely my first God. He was wonderful and wild and crazy. And, you know, first 4 years of my life were absolutely amazing. My daddy was a prominent surgeon and a mainline amphetamine user, and he knew the G-men were after him. So when I was really young, he taught me how to drive fast cars and shoot guns to protect him and to get him away if I needed to. I got to run a household with him. My mom was a typical alcoholic housewife that drank martinis, cried, and went to sleep. So she was basically not a very powerful entity in my life as a child. And I ran a household with him and I had fun, and I called the glass man whenever he drove through the driveway and shot up the front of the house and the dining room plate glass would break. You know, we just hit the ground, get up, call the glass man. Wonderful, exciting. He was big and powerful and amazing. And then by the time I was 8, he was gone and I was drinking on a regular basis. I had my first drink when I was 5 years old. And I needed that drink. Boy, did I need that drink. Because I had crossed the line. You know that line, that infamous line that they talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think no better person to understand this than the young person in sobriety. I didn't have a life and then one day cross a line. I think the line that they're talking about, that invisible line in the sand, is the line that comes from a new pair of glasses. I'm a Chuck C fan, always have been. And if you don't know who he is, hit me up. I'd be happy to tell you. But he didn't write a book. It was actually a talk he gave, is written in a book called A New Pair of Glasses. And he describes our disease as a conscious separation from God and mankind. And I believe that the line is this in the sand is when we become conscious of our separation. Until that time, until we become conscious of the separation, we're fine. I was fine. First 4 years, I was fine. I was excited and life was amazing. But when I was 4 years old and I went to kindergarten, I went early because I was already reading and doing a checkbook. So they thought may as well send her to school. And when I walked into a kindergarten room for the first time, I knew something was really wrong with me because I did not know how to fit into that scenario at all. All these little 4 and 5 year olds running around that room, and I wanted to participate with them. I wanted to be one of them. I wanted to know what to do, and I didn't. I had no clue. I did not know how to connect with those kids, and I made a decision that day that there was something really wrong with me, and I became consciously aware of my separation. So by the time I was 5, which was only a few months later, I was ready for that first Baca, and my world changed, and it went from black and white to color. And what Baca did for me, was it connected me to the world. Because I'm separate. I'm living in hell. I am watching the world, and I am copying in order to fit in. You ever do that? Right? You walk into a situation, and you assess, and you emulate. And I'm good at it. And I think they're amazing actors. Maybe that's why there's so many of them in California. You know, I really think we're fabulous actors. I can take on any role. I can do it, and I can do it well. It's called survival, and it's called connection in a weird sense, because it was my only way. You know, when they said fake it till you make it, I understood that, or at least I thought I did. So I'm faking it. I'm faking it until I get alcohol. And the minute I put alcohol into my body, bam, I connected. It was like I was catapulted over the huge chasm that separated me from you. And that conscious separation was gone. And it was amazing. Wasn't it amazing? It felt like love. Oh my God. I could drink and I could belong. I could drink and I could fit in. I could drink and be in love, which is sometimes not such a good thing. It was amazing. But anytime I didn't have the alcohol, oh my God, the divide became greater and greater and greater and more separated and more aware. And then, of course, when I was drinking, sometimes my behaviors were not really good. You know, like I started hitchhiking around the United States when I was 13. You know, I don't drink and cry and fall asleep. I drink and travel. I love traveling. And when I drink, I see which way the wind's blowing and put out my thumb and off I go. You know, it was kind of the thing in, you know, like 1970 and 1971. I have a lot of energy. I'm kind of a high energy person. I don't know if you could really get that through Zoom, but I am, and I'm 62 years old. So, you know, when I was 13 and 14, woo, I was through the roof with energy, and I never left the house without a bottle in my hand. And so I have a few drinks, I connect with the world, and off I go. When I was 15, I was released from a mental institution. Yeah, you know, they thought maybe a 14-year-old hitchhiking around the United States was problematic, and so they took me for a little help, and that psychiatrist locked me up for a year and a day in a lovely institution, you know, kind of one flew over the cuckoo's nest-esque, where they strapped you down with leather straps and tied you to cots in the halls, and you lose your virginity, you know, not a great place. But when I got out at 15, because the insurance ran out, that psychiatrist told my mom and the new person she was now married to that I was a sociopath and that I was destined to die and that they needed to make funeral arrangements for me because I was going to place myself in a position where I was killed or I was going to implode with my lifestyle. And I finally had my answer because I knew there was something wrong with me, but I didn't know what it was. I'm a sociopath. So I made Steppenwolf's Born to Be Wild my theme song and off I went. And I spent the next 8 years hitchhiking around the United States in blackouts mostly. Not good times. I was with bad people doing bad things in places I didn't want to be. And it wasn't good. So I arrive in Alcoholics Anonymous, February 3rd, 1981. And the reason I arrived there is on February 2nd, 1981, I had a rather brutal altercation. Now, I had a lot of altercations with men and women in my years hitchhiking around the United States, but this particular one was a little more brutal than normal. And, you know, I ended up out on a dock with a guy and he was beating me and various other things. And then I made it home and I called my mom, who's now divorced from the next husband and remarried to an architect and living in Houston, Texas. And I called her and said I was mugged. You know, what else are you going to say, right? Day in the life. And asked her if she'd fly me home or fly me to Houston because I wanted to crash at her place for a while, right? I mean, she's married to an architect. They have a pool. So I fly to Houston on February 3rd, 1981. My mom picks me up at the airport. I'm all beat up. I mean, beat up. One eye swollen shut. My nose split. My lips busted. A couple of ribs broken. Mom doesn't notice. Mom is happy and delightful and wonderful and ecstatic. Because she informs me she's been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous for 3 days. And then she says the words that changed my life. She said, it would mean so much to me if you would come to a meeting with me tonight to support me. And she meant it. It was really about her. And so I went because, of course, I'm going to suck up to mom. I'm going to be Miss Goody Two Shoes because I want to crash at her place for a while. And I'm introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, February 3rd, 1981, smoke-filled trailer in the parking lot of an Episcopal church in Kingwood, Texas. And I walk in and I'm paying attention because I want to know what this gig is my mom's got herself into, right? I mean, we all know mom's an alcoholic. I'm so proud of her. You know, nobody's ever said maybe Holly shouldn't drink because Holly's a sociopath, not an alcoholic. So I go to this meeting and this lady starts talking about being insane. And she catches my attention. And she says that she has not found out she was not terminally insane, that what she had was a disease and that disease was alcoholism. And I got hope for the first time in my life. Very first time. I was fired up, excited. I ran up to the front of the room of the meeting that night. I got that desired chip and I jumped into Alcoholics Anonymous. Woo! I'm an alcoholic! Oh my God, I never wanted to be something more in my life. I mean, I don't understand when people don't want to be one. Like, are you kidding me? Do you want to just be who you are forever? Really? That's what you want to be? Or do you want to be an alcoholic? And if you're an alcoholic, there's a reprieve. All you got to do is work these 12 steps and you never have to feel like that again. Hello. Hello. I'm excited. Where do I sign? Give me a card. I'm in. And I dive in. And people say, keep coming back. What? Nobody ever said that to me. They had my name in front of bars in New Orleans not to let me in. New Orleans. Hello. Yeah, because people's cars, husbands, keys, money disappeared. So now all of a sudden you're saying, keep coming back. Yay. Clubs are open 24 hours a day. So I stay there. I play poker all night with the old timer, smoke cigarettes, talk trash. I mean, all of a sudden you can say things like, I ran my husband over with a truck and then I backed over him because I wanted to see if I actually hit him. And people laugh. Look at Stacey. She's laughing. People laugh at that. They do not laugh at that at the PTA. So all of a sudden I'm home and I get to start sharing things. I get to start, you know how you do when you're new. You know, you tell people things you wish should not tell them, you know, but you don't know. Nobody's introduced you to the steps yet. And if they have, you're not interested, at least if you were like me. So I'm 23, it's 1981, there are not a lot of young people, so we have to find each other. So I go to a meeting over here and find one, and then we get together and we go to a meeting over here and we find another one, and then we find another one, and pretty soon we're starting to make these PAW meetings, you know, because they were just starting, you know, they didn't have PAWs back in the day. And so we're making PAW meetings, and we did Mid-South Regional Conference of Young People in AA on a napkin at a Denny's at 2 a.m, and, you know, we're doing fellowship, and meetings, and I divorced my husband, and, you know, because I was married, I picked a husband up one time on a couple quarts of tequila. So, you know, we had to kind of let that one go. And so I'm single and I'm 23 and I'm sober. Woo! So I go to Hawaii with some guy, you know, because, like, why not? He asked me to join him in sobriety in paradise. Who could turn that down? So I go to Hawaii with this guy and I'm walking down the street on Ali'i Drive on the Big Island on the Kona Coast in the village of Kailua. And I want to kill myself. I'm in paradise. I'm 24. I'm a year sober. And I want to die. Because, you know, it says in the big book, is there a substitute for alcohol? Yes, there is. A fellowship at Alcoholics Anonymous. It'll grow up around you. It'll be amazing. And it is. It is an amazing substitute for alcohol. But it is not the solution for alcoholism. The solution for alcoholism is the 12 steps. And I had not had that. So I was still living on the wrong side of the line. I was still living consciously separate from. I was still faking it till you make it. I was still copying women in sobriety that I could see, young women in sobriety. And I was kind of doing what they were doing and acting like they were acting, except when no one was around, you know. And then you go to a meeting and realize you're sleeping with five people at the table, you know, like that's not good. You know, wearing shirts down to here and skirts up to here and thinking I'm sober, you know, no. So I'm a year sober and I want to kill myself. And instead of doing that, I thought, one more meeting, one more time. And I went to a meeting that night, and I asked a woman to be my sponsor, who said to me, we are now going to start working these steps. Now, I didn't want to. Do you want to? Like, really? Who looks at the steps and says, oh, yeah, I'm down with that? Not me. I looked at the steps and went, oh, great, there's God. I mean, you can't avoid it. Like, who are we kidding? And then they say, oh, just stay in step one. Well, I'm not an idiot. I can read. There's God all over the wall. God. And I knew it was only a matter of time. I wasn't going to make it here. Not because I don't believe in God, because I do. My mom drugged me to church growing up. I had to go to Sunday school. Crayons of Jesus and sheep, you know, and outline the Ten Commandments and Moses and some guy that are ate by a whale, you know, old Jonah. Yeah, that's his name. You know, I had to do all lions, tigers, and bears. Oh, my, you know. And then we had the Ten Commandments on the walls, like in every room, it seemed like. I knew what God wanted of me. God is big and powerful and almighty and pissed off with a really good memory. And, you know, I knew. And so people say, you're early in sobriety. Oh, honey, don't worry. God will forgive you. God will forgive you. You hear that? I think every church has that. It's part of the doctrination, right? Come on in. God will forgive you. Well, that's just great. Fine. God's going to forgive me. The problem with that is I'm not done yet. You know, I don't know about you guys, but I didn't come in here to get good. You know, I was 24. I didn't want my virginity back, okay? You know, I didn't want to wear collars up to here, skirts down to here, and carry a big book around. I didn't want to be at the airport passing out flowers. I didn't want to help others every day. Oh, my God, seriously? Help others? Oh, yeah, geez, sign me up for that. I'm excited. And they used to take us on 12-step calls, so I knew what that meant. They'd throw me in the backseat of a car with a bathroom garbage can. You know, the little I have them in mine, you know, the little small bathroom garbage cans. They'd throw me in the backseat of a car, hand me one of those little trash cans, and off we'd go to an emergency room. We're going to pick up some woman that's going to come out in a bathrobe with a bottle of Librium that they hand to the person picking her up. And I'm in the back seat of the car, and they shoved that woman in the back seat of the car. And I said, what am I supposed to do? And they said, you're supposed to catch it when she vomits. Really? That's service work? Sign me up for that. Yeah, gee, let me give back so freely what was given to me. You know, I didn't want that. And I knew in the middle of the night, all by myself, when it's just me and God, I knew he knew. And if he knows that I plan on maybe dating your boyfriend, you know, I might take $20 out of your wallet. I want to go out with that man because he owns a home. You know, I didn't want to be a good girl, not that good. I just wanted to be a better girl, you know, just a better girl. I didn't want to hurt my mom so much anymore. And I had a 2-year-old little girl at the time, and I wanted to somehow, some way, learn how to be a mom to her instead of just carrying a tattered picture of her in my purse while she's living with her father in Houston. No, I wanted to do some of those things, you know, but I didn't want to give up my lifestyle, you know, my freedom, per se. And I didn't know what to do. It was a conundrum. And I'm going to tell you a story about how God got my attention. And I know probably a lot of you heard it, but I'm going to tell it anyway because it was amazing to me. Because see, what happens is I think God gets our attention, and I think God helps us without our permission. My sponsor says it all the time. God saved her without her permission. Well, he got my attention without mine. So I have this sponsor, right, Cherie, that I get, and she tells me that I have to start. I have to put my God on the shelf because I've already decided my God can't help me, that my God is never going to do anything for me because I'm such a naughty girl. And so she says, we're going to put that God on the shelf, and you're going to talk to mine. And this is what you're going to do. You're going to hit your knees every morning, and you're going to introduce yourself, and you're going to say, good morning, Cherise God. This is Holly. Please help keep me sober today. And then at the end of every day, you're going to hit your knees again, and you're going to refresh his memory, and you're going to say, hi, Cherise God. This is Holly. Thank you for keeping me clean and sober today. And you're going to do that every day. Now, I thought that was the stupidest thing I ever heard in my life. Like, seriously? But I really like her. She's this amazing goddess of a woman. Oh, my God. She was the biggest hippie chick I'd ever seen. She was amazing. Her God did stuff for her all the time. And I had come to believe that her God worked for her. So she's going to share her God with me, which I thought was dumb and ridiculous. But I'm going to do it. And mostly the reason I'm going to do it is because if she tells me to do it and she asks me if I did it, I have to say yes. Because if I say no, she might not like me. And I really, really want her to like me. And she's so cool. Like, she talks to her God and meditates on a nude beach. Like, who does that? That's a level of confidence I wanted, right? So I start doing, and I start talking to her God. Good morning, Cherise God. This is Holly. I'm stupid, and I'm cocky, and I'm defiant, and I'm saying it with absolutely no respect at all. Certainly, like, here I am. Hi. You know, waving at the ceiling, and being facetious, and talking to Cherise God. And then she told me that I need to, in order for me to believe that this God might take care of me, I need to start looking for him. I need to start talking to him during my day. Okay. So I'm walking down the street. I'm not really employable. So I'm walking down the street, heading to the beach, and I'm out of cigarettes. And I see somebody walking towards me. I'm like, okay, Cherise God, here comes Joe from the meeting. So, you know, I could really use a smoke here. So you think Joe will have some smokes on him? I might be able to bum a smoke. Let's see what you're going to do with that one, Cherise God. You know, stuff like that. Just cocky and belligerent and ridiculous. And I did that every day, every day, every day, every day. And the first thing that happened, the very first thing that happened is, you know, there's a line in the 12 and 12, and it's in later steps, but it's relevant for me today. And that line says that we're tortured by loneliness. You know, a conscious separation from God and mankind. Well, that just sounds so existential and delightful. But what it really means is we're tortured by loneliness. I used to not be able to read that sentence without crying because I felt that line in the core of my body. I was isolated and alone. Well, I'm talking to Cherise God every day. I'm carting him around with me. And one morning I said, Mike, good morning, Cherise God. This is Holly. I get up and, okay, here we go. Where are we going today? And I'm about to head out the door. And it hit me. It hit me. Oh, my God. For the first time in my life, I wasn't alone. I was not alone. I had a friend. Yes, he was invisible. But we have to start somewhere. I made my very first conscious connection with an invisible friend called Cherise God. And it was wonderful. Oh my God. Oh my God. It was just like a tiny little glimpse of what being connected might be like. And so I thought, well, here we go. And I went out, you know, kind of put a little pep in my step because I had an invisible friend now. And I carried him with me everywhere. Everywhere I went. Well, what's going to happen now? What's going to happen now? You know, that kind of thing. So there was this guy, right? There's always this guy. Always. God, geez, some things never change. So there's this guy, right? So he's older. He's like, I was 24 and he was like 40. Oh my God. But he was sober like a long time. And I had a year's sobriety, which today I look back on and reflect a bit differently. But anyway, he was super cute. He owned a home and he asked me on a date. Oh my God, right? So I'm all excited to go out with this guy. Now, I want you to know that I believed with every fiber of my being that if a man takes you out to dinner, you sleep with him. Not because you want to sleep with him, but because that's what's expected. It's part of the deal. It's kind of like the tip. Like, you wouldn't leave a restaurant and not leave a tip for good service. So if they take you out for a restaurant, to a restaurant for a nice meal, certainly they need to receive something in return. And that is just an expectation that you have to fulfill. If you don't fulfill that, then you're a bad person because that's necessary. So Jim asked me to go out to dinner. So he takes me out to dinner. We go out to dinner. Afterwards, he says, would you like to go back to my place? And I say, yes, of course, because that's what you're supposed to say. Not because I actually wanted to go back to his place. So we go back to Jim's place. We're on the couch in the living room. We're making out, right? And then he says, would you like to go into the bedroom? And I say, of course, because that's what you say, because that's what's expected. That's what you do. So then I said, I need to freshen up in the bathroom first, because that's what we say, and that's what we do. So I go into the ladies' room. I go into his powder room to freshen up before we go into the bedroom. And I realized I had a really big problem. And I started to cry because I didn't know what to do. Because I have Cherise God with me. And oh my God, what am I going to do with him? I mean, I can't say, excuse me, can you wait out here? I'm going to go in the back. I'll be right back. You know, like, what do you say? And I'm talking to him in the bathroom and I'm like, I don't know what to do. And I'm crying and this guy's going to think I'm insane. Oh my God, I'm going to look terrible. He's never going to ask me out again. This is horrible. I can't do what I'm supposed to do. And it was terrible. And so I came out of the bathroom and I'm crying and I look at Jim and I go, I have to go home. And he's like, what? Oh my God. You know, and he was like in the mood. So they don't take that really well. So I, you know, like, I have to go home. And he's like, why do you have to go home? And I'm, because I have Cherie's God with me and I just can't. And you have to take me home. And he's like, oh my God. Okay. I bet he never asked another newcomer out on a date. Maybe I, you know, he dropped me off. He wasn't real warm and fuzzy about the whole thing, you know, and he dropped me off and I went in the apartment. I cried myself to sleep that night because it was terrible. It was horrible. It was humiliating. It was shame in reverse. You know, it was just horrible. And the next day, Jim called me the next day. And this is what he said to me. He said, hey, how are you? And I said, I'm good. And he says, I want you to know I had a lovely time last night. And I was wondering if you'd like to have dinner with me again. I don't remember when it was. A few days later. And I said yes, and I hung up the phone. And I started to cry. Because for the very first time in my life, I was a lady. For the very first time in my life, I had dignity. And I didn't do it on purpose. I didn't try to do it. I did it kicking and screaming. My God did something for me. Cherie's God did something for me I didn't ask him to do. I never even fathomed that happening. And it was one of the most amazing gifts I got in early sobriety. Cherie's God gave me the word no. Cherie's God gave me a choice that I'd never had in my life before then. It was unbelievable. Unbelievable. So I tell Cherie about it and she laughs. Oh my God, one guy got away unscathed like it was a joke. But it was kind of funny. And then she told me that it was time for me to come up to her house and hit my knees and do step three, that I was ready. Was I ready to trust this God? Was I ready to stop trusting my thinking? Isn't that the deal? Isn't that the lesson in that moment? Because based on solid information for the previous 24 years of my life, every fact and every situation lined up to that moment, that night in Jim's house, that I was supposed to sleep with him. That was the truth. That was my truth. And I had substantiating evidence for the 24 years of my life to prove it. And I was wrong. I was completely and totally wrong. So was I willing, just maybe, to maybe be wrong about anything else? Because isn't that what they're asking us when you read page 60 through 63 in the big book? It talks about all of our fabulous ideas, all of our management, all of us trying to lay out all the players. I am multitask oriented. I have leadership capabilities. I'm a fabulous delegator. I can lay out scenario after scenario after scenario. I can do all of that, and that is fabulous on a resume, and it is absolutely in the character defect column. So am I willing? And I said yes. And I went to Cherie's house and I hit my knees and I said the third step prayer with her, and nothing happened. Nothing. I got up. I'll never forget it. I got up and I looked at her and she's all smiley. You know how sponsors get, you know, they do the third step prayer and then they're like, oh, this is so wonderful. And you're like, okay. You know, and I thought, oh, here it is. Pedal to the metal. Nothing happened. Nothing happened. And then she told me that that was okay because it wasn't supposed to happen. It was just a decision. The frog had not jumped off the lily pad, which made absolutely no sense to me at the time. But I just shook my head and went, okay, you know, because that's what we do. I tell you that I had a different experience of the third step a few years later. I launched into the steps with Cherie and my life changed dramatically. And I went back to the United States to complete my ninth step amends because nobody was in Hawaii, and began being a mother to my daughter and ex-wife to my ex-husband and an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I was 7 years sober, I moved to Jacksonville, Florida to get married. And I married a button-up sweater guy. I married a guy that wasn't in the program, that was a real citizen that my parents introduced me to because I would never have met him. And I married Michael, and I was grateful and happy, and my life was amazing. And I had gotten a college degree, and I was managing a company and being a good wife and being a good mother. And we each had a daughter, and we decided to have more kids. I had two baby boys, and helping with his architectural business. And I became Catholic because, you know, why not? Not a big jump. And I was teaching CCD. And I was grateful for all the gifts this program gave me. And I got away from AA. I was so busy taking care of the gifts that I forgot to take care of the disease. And then picking up a drink again. At 13 and a half years sober, I picked up a drink. And I control drank because of breastfeeding my youngest son at the time for a year. And it was horrible. It was a horrifying experience. I never, ever want to control my drinking ever again. It's terrible. You don't want to. Trust me. I don't want to. I do not want to drink like normal people. It sucks. So after a year of doing that, I weaned my youngest son, and I ended up running back into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God. And I got the chip I hold today. And that was September 28, 1996. When I got that chip, I was back in Kailua Kona, Hawaii. And I was sitting on the steps of the church in realization that I had been drinking for a year and that my life passed before my eyes. I was filled with a tear I've never experienced before in my life. And when that meeting opened up, I went into that meeting that night, and I had completed steps 1, 2, and 3 on the steps of that church. And it was a very different step 3. Very different. You see, I always thought that God was at the helm and I was at the keel. You know, that God was guiding the ship, but I was kind of making the twists and turns. You know, that I have the power of choice, which I do. I have the power of choice. And that I could make decisions and go down alleys, and God was there to rescue me. God was there to carry me through the decisions that I made. God was there to carry me. Like it talks about in Footprints poem. I'm mistaken the Footprints poem for I lead the way and you carry me through the pain. And when I sat on the steps that day, I reflected on my life and I realized that I make decisions based on self that hurt people. Hurt people. When I think I know something, and I really believe that I know, and that all the facts line up, and it seems like the right idea, and I lead anyone else down that path, I have subjected them to being hurt. And the only examples I can give you are my own, so I'm going to share those with you, and then we'll end. I married a man that was wonderful. He is still. He's my ex-husband. He's a wonderful man, a wonderful man. When I met him, I told him I tried marijuana once and I didn't like it. And that's all I told him. I mean, he knew I was an Alcoholics Anonymous and he thought it was commendable that I stopped drinking so young. He had no idea my story, none whatsoever. And when we were married 6 months, I rode my bicycle about 2 miles from my house to his office. And I had to go on a pretty major highway. I mean, you know, it's just like a 4-lane road. Like, don't get me wrong. It's not the interstate, right? 4-lane road with a median in the middle like that, right? So I ride to his office and I go in and I surprise him. Hi, honey. I'm here to go to lunch with you. And my car was in the shop or something. I don't even know where my car was. And he said, oh, that's delightful. You know, 6 month married, you know, you're still like all over each other. So he thought that was wonderful that I was there. And then he said, wait, how did you get here? And I said, oh, it's a beautiful day. I mean, I do live in Jacksonville, Florida. I rode my bicycle. And he looked up from his desk with horror on his face. And he said, oh, my God, you rode your bike on Beach Boulevard? Do you know how dangerous that is? And I had about a tenth of a second in my brain. This is what happened in my brain. I said to myself, seriously? Dangerous? I hitchhiked around the United States for a decade. I drove a Corvette when I was 4. I shot guns when I was 3. This man is concerned about me riding a bicycle on Beach Boulevard. He has no idea who I am. And I made a decision based on all the facts that I had at the time and all the gratitude I had in my heart and all the program that I had put in the bank for those 7.5 years at this point. And every fiber of my being that loved this man. And I said to him in an instant, oh, Michael, I'm so sorry. We walked to the restaurant. We had lunch. After lunch, he put my bicycle back in the trunk of his car. And he drove me home so that he knew I was safe and secure and away from the dangerous Beach Boulevard. What I did in that moment was I took the helm. I took the helm in a way I had no right to take it. Because what I did in that moment, in that instant, standing in that man's office with love in my heart, please know that I loved him with all my heart. What I did was I took away his power of choice. I did not let him choose. I made the decision for him. I became what he needed me to be for him to love me. Because had he known who I was in that moment, I don't know that we would have been married much longer. And I stayed married for 8 years. And when I ran back into Alcoholics Anonymous in September of 1996, I looked at him and I said, there's a lot you need to know about me, and I have got to get back in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. That was a close call, and I could have died. I could have done horrible things to this family. I could have thrown my kids in the car. There are just so many things that could have happened had I not been breastfeeding my youngest son. So many things that could have happened. And I sat Michael down and I told him my story, because this time I gave my life to God. I did a third step like I'd never done before in my life. I conceded to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. I came to believe that a power greater than me could restore me to sanity so that that obsession to alcohol could be removed. And then I turned my will and my life over to the care of him. And then I got honest. Rigorously honest. And I sat Michael down and I said, I'm going to tell you my story and I'll never forget it. We sat out on our screen patio of our beautiful home, and he's not understanding this whole AA thing, and he thinks his wife has had early menopause or something. He has no idea what's happening. And I told him my story, and he cried and I cried, and we were crying for different reasons. I knew my ex-husband would not like me. We've been divorced 23 years. My ex-husband does not like me. He thinks I'm crazy. He thinks I need medication. He thinks I'm wild. He thinks that all of those things. He doesn't understand me at all. Not at all. And how could he? How could he? He's a button-up sweater guy. He's from Saint-Jean, Quebecien. He moved to the United States when he was 12. He's college degree, he was protected and loved. He was everything I'm not and am. See, I'm both. I am a good person. I have lots of love in my heart. Absolutely amazing to me what life has given me. But I know without a shadow of a doubt that I cannot make choices for others. I can't. And yet, I wake up every morning, and I have a moment, sometimes longer, when I think I can, because I have the disease of alcoholism. and I'm filled with 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. And left to my own devices, I'm going to step on the toes of my fellows, seemingly with love in my heart, with only their best interest in mind. And I'm going to later place myself in a position to be harmed. And I'm going to be in the bathroom. And I'm going to be asking God to help me. Because I just want to love somebody. And I don't know if it's safe. And I don't know if I should. And I don't know if I'm an idiot. And I don't know if I'll look good or if I'll look bad or if they're even interested. And I want to take a direction that I want to take because it seems to me to be the safest path. I still do it. I do it all the time, all the time. And invariably, when I have the tear tracks running down my face, I give it back. I give it back. Because the fact that I even think I have control is an illusion anyway. I have no control over this universe, none. I don't have any control over you or you or you or you. And the only time that I'm in turmoil, the only time that I'm in conflict is when I perceive that I do. When I perceive that I have a choice that doesn't even exist. I used to say that I aspire to be fearless. That was my goal, and that I would never achieve it until the moment after death. That moment, that nirvana moment, that 5 seconds after everything shuts down, and I finally completely and totally let go of my humanity, because that is my ego, right? When I let that go, I'll have that moment of complete fearlessness. And that was the goal. And what I know today is that is not my goal. As long as I try to be fearless, I'm going to be in conflict. I know today that all I need to do is be brave. That's it. I just have to be brave. I just have to keep my little feet walking in the right direction, even when I'm terrified, absolutely terrified. I still pray on a regular basis for God to forgive me tomorrow, right? Because I already know what I have in mind. I ask God to help me to prevent the wreckage of my future, because the decisions I make today, the consequences may not come for a month or 6 months or 8 years. That's how long it was with Michael. I made a decision at 6 months married. We were married for 8. But the consequences come. So I try as best I can every day to stay out of my way. To stay out of my way. Because there is nothing more important to me than you. Nothing. And sometimes it doesn't look like that. Sometimes I start to think I'm important. You know, like how I feel about things. Is important. But I never feel joy when I do that, never. The joy always comes, and I mean it comes in an instant. It floods in, like comes from above and through and out. The joy always comes when I think about you, when I look at my screen right now, and I see Tally's little face, who I have just met and love with all my heart. Because I feel her. I feel her. What a gift. My sober sister, my wife, Paula, who you are going to have the honor and privilege of hearing next. That woman warms my soul with her humor and her wisdom. And if I keep me out of the way, I get to touch you. I get to touch you. And that is more joy than I will ever have, ever. Stacy, look at her little face. Oh, my God. And she has a most amazing summer coming up, and I know all about it. Because I listened when she called to tell me. Isn't that what the third step is about? Get me out of the way, God, please. Get me out of the way. I cannot wrest satisfaction and happiness out of the world doing it my way. All I have to do is shut up, get out of the way, and I'm flooded with joy. But I have to do it every day, every day. Ugh. But it's worth every moment. I do not have to give back what was so freely given to me as penance. I am honored, honored to give back what was so freely given to me, because the reward for me is insurmountable, and I looked for it in the bottom of a vodka glass for so long, and I found it right here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Stacy, thank you so much for asking me to be here today. You've once again given me the opportunity to be filled with joy, and I love you. Thank you.